Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Last week on the show, we spoke with Discover Magazine editor Steve George about the magazine's picks for the most important science stories of 2013. At the top of the list was discoveries made on the planet Mars. And so it should be no surprise that our astronomy contributor, Jean Creighton, also includes Mars on her list of top astronomical stories of the past 12 months. She talked with Bonnie North and explained why.
Curiosity is the latest rover that has landed on Mars. By the way, there's another spacecraft on its way to Mars now. Curiosity landed very successfully in August of 2012, and it was sometime in February that its instruments pierced a hole about 2.5 inches in a rock, and it was designed to have all these analytical instruments on board so they could take that little piece of debris from Mars and analyze it chemically. And we found that not only was Mars a liquid environment, but also more interestingly is that the water was not acidic, not too alkaline, or too salty. And this is significant because although we all agree now there's been plenty of data suggesting that there was lots of water on Mars and for long periods of time, and liquid water, I mean, we weren't quite sure whether there would be enough salt in the water to make it impractical for life to flourish. So it turns out that Mars has been, at least, I should say, a very promising place for life. Furthermore, it had all the building blocks of life as we know it. So we found sulfur, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and carbon in this rock on Mars. I don't think the suggestion is that there's life or that there has been, at least not based on this data, but I think the suggestion is that all the building blocks were there. Whether the opportunity arose, we don't know yet. I mean, this is a small sample. How could we possibly exclude that there were some bacteria, for example, on Mars? But for now, we just have the suggestion that it was a friendly place to life at some point.
Which is very cool. Just in and of itself.
And frankly, I prefer that we don't have terrible monsters emerging from Mars.
Yes, me too. But we did have, this is the second thing on our list, summing up the year in astronomy, there was a fireball in Russia that was pretty scary. Talk about scary things coming from outer space.
It was, which is a nice segue, yes. This was, interestingly enough, the same day that we expected a pretty close visit from an asteroid. These two events turned out to be utterly unconnected. The fireball in Russia turned out to be between 55 and 59 feet. It glowed for 35 seconds, which is an eternity. That's a very long time to see a meteor. They're called fireballs when they're at least the brightness of a planet, by the way. And it exploded about 14 miles above sea level. Thankfully, no, there were no fatalities, but 1,700 people were injured and 7,000 buildings were damaged. Most of these buildings were not damaged by direct hits from debris, as you might expect, but of the compressed air.
I was going to say the concussion.
Yes. Yeah, so the air got compressed, so that basically creates a shock and it blows out windows. 7,000 buildings were damaged. Perhaps what makes this event deserving to be in the five top was that it catapulted some discussion about, well, things like this could happen at any moment, especially if you're looking from objects that are too close to the sun that our regular satellites wouldn't see. So now people are talking about other ways of detecting such objects and learning more about asteroids, the kinds of objects that are most likely generating these. So it's been decided that in 2016, OSIRIS-REx is going to go to an asteroid and return a sample in 2023. Furthermore, there's been this huge advertising for ideas, basically call for ideas to see how could we capture an asteroid and move it.
Oh, so in other words, to prevent it from hitting us.
Yeah, if something was coming too close, what could we do about that? And that, I think, might be a very exciting segue to things to come and learn more about these asteroids and what we could do if things went south for us.
Going back out into space now is number three, which is Voyager 1. And my understanding is that it's in interstellar space now, right? What does that mean?
In different places, you'd hear the news item differently. But let's just remind ourselves that Voyager 1 was a spacecraft that left the Earth, I think, in 1977. So they were built to last. And they was going to do the grand voyage of the solar system. It would get to Jupiter and Saturn, and then it would fly out of the plane of the solar system and keep going for as long as possible. At the moment, it looks like it has enough battery, as it were, enough energy to continue to send transmissions until 2020 that would be strong enough for us to be able to detect. And the idea was that this is going to become the object that people have made that's gone farthest from Earth. So it is now at approximately 126 astronomical units, which means it is 126 times farther than the distance between the Earth and the Sun. Why it got into the news was that the Sun creates a bubble around the whole solar system, basically. And that's because there's a strong magnetic field and there's also a lot of radiation that basically washes away all the particles, the charged particles and the neutral particles that would be streaming through the what we call interstellar space. So we have a protection bubble thanks to the Sun. It turns out that Voyager 1 has traveled far enough that we're outside of that highly protective bubble, and now we can measure the kind of concentrations of those interstellar particles that you would expect beyond that, beyond what we call the heliopause.
To use Star Trek parlance, it's gone beyond the shields.
Yes, it's gone beyond the shields. But I should point out, though, that some headlines where it left the solar system, which isn't quite right, because the solar system is considerably larger if we consider that the Oort cloud, we've talked about this together before, that is the very distant sphere of frozen materials that give birth to comets eventually, that would be 10,000 astronomical units away. And that would be a better definition of what the edge of the solar system is. In other words, what we consider our solar system is the part of space that's mostly influenced by the gravity of the Sun. If you go past the Oort cloud a bit, well, then you're as likely as not to be attracted to the other star next to us.
Right.
I love this romantic idea that this is as far as something that we've touched, how far it's gone.
Well, that takes us to number four on the list, which is something that actually looks at things that are well beyond our solar system, which is exoplanets. And that's the Kepler telescope, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So what's going on with that? I know it sent us a lot of wonderful data.
It had a major press release in January of 2013. And the current candidate number is approximately 3,500. 3,500 exoplanets, Bonnie. Who would have thought that 20 years ago? It was such a dream. This spacecraft launched in March of 2009, and it has looked for 4 years at 160,000 stars. And the point was that if a planet is accompanying that star that we're looking at, then the brightness of the star is going to change as the planet comes in front of it. Now, it turns out that there are many reasons why the brightness of a star might change. Maybe it's a planet, maybe it has some sunspots or the equivalent of, maybe it has some flares or other things are going on. So we need at least three what we call transits of the planet in front of the Sun and measure those dips. So it turns out that some stars are much naughtier than the Sun, and we need many more than three to do that. So we learn something about stars in addition to learning about planets around other solar systems. We found now, I think the count is over 300 that are similar in size with the Earth. That doesn't mean that we found 300 Earths, because, of course, they need decent temperatures, they need an atmosphere, they need lots of things. But the fact that we have so much raw material to work with, and then we can zoom in on those worlds with other instruments and understand a little better their properties, is, I think, a triumph. Not to be lessened by the fact that after 4 years, its third gyroscope, so what helped the telescope point accurately to its targets failed, which was past the warranty, so we can't really complain. But it seems like NASA has found a way of using the telescope in any case. So the worst case scenario is that we can't get as good data as we have, but we still have at least a year's worth of data to sift through. So the discoveries have certainly not ended. But it looks like we might even be able to continue observing with this marvelous spacecraft.
And that brings us to number five on your top five list from 2013. We've gotten new data. We're back to more discovery.
We are. I'm particularly fond of cosmology because that whole field, in some ways, from an observational point of view, came into its own within my career. I'm talking about a spacecraft called Planck that's observing in microwaves. So that is part of the light, part of the electromagnetic spectrum that has wavelengths that are longer than what we can see with our eyes. This light, the microwave background that we see, so if you look in any direction of the sky with a microwave telescope, you will see there's a huge band that follows the Milky Way. But if you set that aside, every other place has a low-grade background that's sitting at about 3 degrees Kelvin. That's 3 degrees above absolute zero. We discovered this in 1967. Penzias and Wilson picked up a Nobel Prize for this observation. But people thought, where is this coming from? Eventually, we got the theorists lined up with the observations, and we realized that this had been predicted. The Big Bang Theory predicts that at about 400,000 years after the beginning of time, T equals zero, I call dramatically, after 400,000 years, light and matter separate, go their separate ways. Before then, the universe was so hot that light was absorbed, re-emitted so quickly that it really didn't have any freedom to go anywhere. But at about 400,000 years, light finally was free to move, and that's the light from that part of the universe, that early time in the universe, that's almost 13 billion years ago now, that's the light that we see. So we actually are bathed in the light from the Big Bang.
From the beginning of time.
Almost the beginning. Almost, to be precise. Almost, yeah. Not quite. So there has been a series of instruments, and each time that a complete survey is done, more details come through. So we still, for example, know that the age of the universe is approximately 13.8. I'm not going to quote more decimal places. That's good enough. 13.8 billions of years. That the universe is made of approximately 5% of what we call regular matter. So that would be you and me, stars, galaxies. 27% what we call dark matter. So that is material that we can't directly see, but we can feel its gravitational effects. And then, of course, there's the lovely, mysterious 68%, that is most of the universe, that we call fondly dark energy. We don't know necessarily the nature of it yet, but we do know that it's forcing the universe to accelerate in its expansion.
And all of that
came to fruition this year. So they made an announcement this fall. In addition to kind of fine-tuning some of the observations that we had, it also is poised to look at the radiation from a different point of view. I mean, this light that I've described has been studied and squeezed for all it's worth because it really contains so much information about the beginning of the universe and its future. But in addition, it looks like if you look at the modes of the light, so the light would appear to vibrate in two different modes. They're both kind of tricky to see. We call this polarization. One type of polarization that they're poised to measure could give us real information even before that decoupling, that 400,000 years, when the universe was so young, so less than a few minutes old, we would have what we call inflation, when the universe grew from smaller than the size of an atom to a size of a cherry. And this inflation was such a dramatic, one of the most dramatic events in the universe. We would love to get a better handle on how that worked exactly. So as you can imagine, everybody's drooling over where that might lead us.
Well, and of course, that means for us in our conversations next year and the year beyond and whatever, we'll have plenty to talk about.
We always do.
We always do. Jean, have a wonderful holiday and new year, and we'll catch you in January.
Thank you very much.
Gene Creighton is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee and our regular astronomy contributor. She talked with Bonnie North about her picks for the top astronomy stories of 2013. Another break now, and then some can't-miss ideas for eating out in and near Milwaukee over the holidays. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.